All right, welcome back to another episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. I'm with our regular co-host, Carson Odegaard, and we have a special guest, Melanie Weaver, with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. She is the waterfowl program biologist. We're going to be talking about the recent BPOP surveys and the recent numbers in California and what hunters should look forward to for this 25-26 waterfowl season. Melanie, thank you so much for joining us. And before we get into the details about the BPOP surveys, can you tell us a little bit more about your background, how you got started in waterfowl management, kind of what drew you to this line of work?
Sure. It was a long time ago. I think I graduated from Sac State in 96, I want to say, in conservation biology. And before I graduated, I was a scientific aide with the department, Fish and Game at that time. And I was trying my hardest to get a temp job in wildlife management. And I eventually did. I started out in fisheries. And I happened to land one in the waterfowl program at that time. And I absolutely loved it. I loved the birds. I loved the hunting community. I love the camaraderie on the management side of waterfowl and how it's a shared resource with the other states and the service. And that's where I've been. And I had a really good mentor when I was starting out, and he taught me a lot. And this is where I ended up. And I'm quite pleased that I had that kind of fortune to land this job over time. They're hard to get. There's not a lot of positions out there.
No, especially now with all the cuts going on, there's even fewer. But how long have you been in your current role?
Oh, let's see, 2025, probably around 2013.
Okay, well, so lots of changes from then and now.
Yes and no. Thankfully, our department is pretty steady overall, and as well as how we manage waterfowl within the state and working with other states in the flyway and the service. So that's pretty consistent, and we're fortunate to have that as well, given the structure that we've had in place since the 40s.
Awesome. So you guys just recently published the California Waterfowl Breeding Population Survey, also known as the BPOP survey. Can you explain why is that important, kind of how it's done, and what are you guys looking for when you're doing these studies or surveys?
Sure. So let's see. Why is it important? Well, beyond the public trust responsibility, because we host these populations within our state, and it's important to ensure that we manage them, monitor them into the future, not just for hunting, but for the bigger picture. But because we hunt these species, waterfowl, it is mandatory that we monitor them. And that way we ensure we're making the appropriate management decisions, and we provide opportunity commensurate with the population status.
How exactly do you complete the survey? That's something I'm not aware of.
Complete what now?
Complete the survey. How exactly does it get done?
Okay, so let's see. So there's strata throughout the state, and each strata has similar habitat, if you will, in terms of hosting breeding ducks. And so we've got about 9 strata, and within these strata we have transects. And we fly these transects in a fixed wing plane. There's 2 observers, myself in the front, and then a person behind the pilot in the back. And we look out each side of our own respective windows. And we count whatever we see on these transects. So we fly about 100 feet off the ground, 80 to 100 miles per hour. And we note what species we see about a quarter mile out on each side of the plane. And we note if they're paired, single, and what species. And then we record that. And it takes about a week in the Central Valley to do the survey. And then we've got another couple of days in the northeastern strata, which is Modoc, Lassen, Siskiyou, that area. So some of the days are pretty full flying. A lot of it has to do with taxiing to get to the next transect. So we fly all the way from, like I said, northeastern portion of the state all the way down to nearly Bakersfield to conduct the survey.
Wow.
It's a lot of flight time.
Yeah. I mean, and how difficult is that? I mean, you've been doing it for a while. You have someone in the back seat. How long does it take for someone to get trained to really figure out what's on the ground, if it's a mallard versus a gadwall, et cetera? It seems hard.
It does seem hard, but if you're a decent birder or a decent hunter and you can identify your ducks by wings, that's pretty critical. What helped me way back in the day is attending the wing bee, where you just look at duck wings day in and day out for that week. And that's pretty critical in identifying ducks out there on the survey. Now, it's not like winter surveys. They're not really concentrated out there. I mean, we're talking about there's a pair, there's a drake. So it's not, they're not large concentrations. They're spread all over the place. So it's a lot simpler than what it sounds like, although there is some getting used to of the plane going forward. You're turned out to the side of the plane, and you're having to scan this environment a quarter mile out. You have to, you know, train your eyes to look for where the ducks will likely be, and you get used to that over time. And you'll see a canal, and you go, okay, I know I'm probably going to see a mallard there in that drainage ditch or canal. So it's just experience over time. Generally, we wouldn't throw someone in the plane and have them be a real observer first time out without any experience. Attending the wing bee's mandatory, really. And I don't care how good of a waterfowl hunter or birder they are, they really need to attend the wing bee just to get those visuals in their minds when they're looking out at the window in the plane. And usually we'll have them in the plane and do a few surveys with the real observers so they gain some experience that way, or we do some practice flights. I've been doing it since 98, minus a couple of years for COVID and when I was with baby. So many years have been doing this.
Are there areas where, like, you know, you go and do a transect and, you know, it's extremely, you know, there's a lot of ducks. Is it some type of an indication of how the overall, you know, survey is going to go if you go to the same area and there's, you know, lots of ducks there or not very many? Is that some type of indication, like, in your mind? I mean, I have areas where I grew up and I am hunting of, like, okay, if there's ducks over here, it's an indication of there's lots of ducks around, let's say.
Not really, because the decent habitat is generally always decent habitat on this survey. So if we're not going to see ducks on these really good areas, oh my gosh, the sky's falling. So it's really how widely distributed across all of the transects is a big indication. Strata like the East Valley or the West Valley, when we see more ducks on those, it'll probably stand out to us. Just means better precipitation, better habitat. Wow, this is probably going to be a good year. But we always expect to see ducks, for example, in the Sac Valley or northeastern California. The places that have water generally always have water, and you expect to see ducks there. So basically is we know that after we're done with the survey, we know better to say, oh, it's going to be up this year or it's going to be down this year, unless it's really, really bad and you don't ever want to see that. But we wait till we transcribe the data and we compare it to previous years. You know, speculation is dangerous, but like you said, you do get gut feelings. And if I don't see many ducks, for example, in the Sac Valley, we know it's probably not going to be such a great year. But that's that strata, right? We've got other strata that we still need to fly, so that doesn't necessarily paint a poor picture.
And what really stood out with the recent survey? Were there any surprises or anything that, you know, people should be excited about?
I'm not going to say there were any surprises. It was just really nice to see that our numbers are coming back a little bit. Mm-hmm. We've had several years of decent precipitation with full reservoirs. So that's really helped. And with those conditions persisting for a couple, 3 years in a row, you would expect our breeding population to do the boom part instead of just the bust part. And that's what's so good about ducks, right? They're resilient. They can handle drought. They can go through those cycles, and then they can have better hatch on those years where we have good habitat.
Yeah, so like you said, so overall, it looks like we increased 27% from 2024 in just overall ducks, but still 11% below the long-term average. And then mallards increased significantly over last year at 49%, but still, you know, 16% below the long-term average. But yeah, I mean, kind of like you know, multiple wet years in a row, I think everyone has seen that kind of on the landscape. I know, you know, in Sassoon Marsh, we have kind of ducklings of all stages at our property down there. And, you know, hopefully the good weather continues and we have nice precipitation for the next couple of years and get out of those drought cycles. But
yeah, and I think that's what we're seeing. We're finally to the stage where we're seeing, you know, the previous year's production contribute to the current year's breeding population. And then, of course, better habitat, more breeders on the landscape. And then those hens maybe have bigger clutch sizes, recruitment's higher. So it all adds up, but it's going to take time, right? And again, because ducks are resilient, thank goodness, they can go through these drought cycles and they can go through these boom cycles. That's what we would expect.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a good explanation because I know personally when, you know, you get a good year of precipitation, like, oh, the numbers are going to be great next year. Well, yeah, they could be better than the year before, but the compounding factor, like you said, of like, okay, you get 1 year, they have better clutches, and then those are now breeders the next year. So the compounding factor now 3 years later, after 3 years of consecutive water years, we're finally seeing bigger numbers on the landscape. That makes a lot of sense in my mind. Cause I was thinking, you know, what's the difference between year one after a drought and year three after a drought? We're still getting the same amount of water, but I guess all those birds that were hatched out successfully for all the good reasons and are now breeding are multiplying that factor.
Correct. So it takes some time, right? Especially when we were in a drought condition for so long. Let's see, I think it started around 2013 or 14, and it went for several years in a row. And of course, there's been habitat changes on the landscape. We're not dealing with the same environment we were in the 90s and the early 2000s. Things have changed. So there's a certain amount of carrying capacity on the landscape, and I think we've adjusted to the new normal, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. There were some other numbers that I was pretty interested about, you know, like gadwall are up, you know, basically close to 50% from last year. Is that more of a, are they kind of, do they, it doesn't seem like they follow the mallards' trends of kinds of ups and downs. I mean, over the years from 92, you know, you have a low of 34,000 and then, you know, a high of, you know, 137,000. Is that more like a northeastern thing and like a Grizzly Island type population? I mean, it seems like they just go up and down and not necessarily for, I'm not going to say any good reason, but it doesn't seem like it's really the same as the mallard populations as they go down.
Yeah, they're later nesters, so they nest a little bit later. Maybe that's a good thing in certain years, and maybe it's bad. Overall, gadwall are doing quite well, as well as shovel in California. They've managed to be a bit more successful than our mallards in the recent years.
Yeah, I know. It seems like in Sassoon, we're seeing a lot more gadwall. Always there, obviously, but I mean, it just seems like in recent years, the landscape, absolutely, there's been a lot more.
Yep, absolutely. If you were to, I'd have to go back and plot the different graphs through time for for those species, you know, by strata, but definitely gadwall and shovelers have really been the success story in California with this new kind of environment that we're dealing with in terms of habitat and precipitation.
Yeah, how does the drought affect those, you know, like you talk about shovelers and gadwall doing well. I mean, why have they done well over, you know, let's call it, you know, the mallards?
Well, it probably has to do with their life histories and how they respond to whatever's on the landscape. You know, drought affects nesting cover, adjacent brood waters needed. If females have to leave their natal area, which is where they hatched, if they have to leave their natal area because they prefer to stay there, they're familiar with it, they know the resources, but if they have to leave because the habitat's poor, you're going to delay nesting, and that reduces energy reserves. You're flying, that's reducing energy reserves. You're probably going to produce a smaller clutch size. Perhaps recruitment's not going to be as good either. So all those conditions add up, and you know, apparently mallards are a heck of a lot more affected than, say, gadwall and shovelers in this situation. And I'd have to look at the strata, but I'm guessing that, as you alluded to, for at least the Susan Marsh, we see a heck of a lot of shovelers and gadwall there, as well as northeastern strata. And those two strata are pretty consistent in terms of habitat coverage. And it's not as manipulated, say, as the Central Valley. And those species they just happen to do quite well with the conditions that are laid out for them.
And in perfect conditions, let's say it was perfect conditions in the spring and through the late summer, what's realistic for a hen? How many clutches could they successfully hatch? Like if it was just perfect conditions?
Oh, they would do one. They are able to do two, right? If something happens with their first, it's not successful. If it's early enough where the hen could still put on enough reserves to do that second clutch attempt, that's great. But they're still going to not be as successful as, say, a hen that does one clutch and she does it early. Like I said, the later they do it, the less successful they are. They've already you know, wasted some energy reserves. So all of that has to be built up again. So generally it's one brood, one clutch.
So pretty rare to do more than one.
You know, without citing a paper or looking at that. Don't put me in a box.
No. Well, I mean, I've heard this for many years of, oh, I think they had two or three clutches this year. Well, it's just different timing of when hens
actually. They're not
doves. Yeah.
Not doves. No, that it takes lots of energy to go through all that, right? And yeah. If they lose that nest, that clutch, real late after she sat on them for a long time, she's probably not going to have the ability to gain the energy reserves back and go through all of that again. And, you know, she's going to have to find another male as well, because he's taken off at that point. So she's going to have to find someone to pair up with again, which isn't going to be hard. But nonetheless, there's a lot of things that get in her way that would make recruitment go down in that situation. So for the most part, ducks, at least ours in California, at least mallards that we're talking about, you know, they're going to be hopefully successful with one brood. And you know, they're not doves and they're not going to lay multiple clutches.
Yeah, no, it's good to clarify, because God, I've heard that forever, and I've just heard it the other day from somebody, and I was like, yeah, I don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah, it's been a wet spring. I saw a bird on her third clutch. You're like, okay.
And how do they know sure. that? How do you know that? Do you know that hen? Yeah. Did she tell you her name? Yeah.
Right. Exactly. That's funny.
Is there a certain strata throughout the state that show stronger breeding success throughout the years than others?
Show stronger what throughout the year?
Breeding success.
Well, breeding success. So you're talking about eggs that hatch and fledge?
Yes.
We would have to do some sort of a survey and monitor that. And that's really intensive. So no, that's not something we monitor.
Hurry up. Our first 2025-26 hunt program deadline is this Saturday for all of our dove hunts from the Butte Sink all the way down to Kern County. Apply today, calwaterfowl.org. We also have one deer hunt. So hunt over safflower fields that are going to get cut this week. Should be a great opportunity. We also have our first ever longest pintail feather. So check it out on our website. But basically, longest pintail feather wins, a Beretta and a spec call. Second place is going to get a Savage. And third place is going to get our decoy of the year, which is a Sprig decoy, celebrating our 80th year this year. Also, other things we have coming up, we have Bingos and Brew August 21st. We also have the Watsonfield Banquet the 21st. And the 23rd of August, we have our Benicia Banquet. So calwaterfowl.org right now. And do you, how do you guys use, you know, some of the data and surveys to, you know, make the framework for hunting regulations in the seasons? How does that process work? Because I think a lot of people are very confused on when it's done, when it's finalized, et cetera.
So the surveys are flown in the spring, right? They coincide with peak nesting in California. And then that information gets fed into what's called the Western Mallard model, which is also adaptive harvest management at the flyaway level. So historically, let's see, or at least since 96 to about 2007, we used the AHM process, but it was based off of mid-continent mallard populations. So traditional breeding area, the prairies, for example. We've known that most of the stocks that contribute to hunting in this flyway originate in this flyway. So we worked long and hard to get the Western Mallard model developed. And so now we're using California data along with Alaska, British Columbia, Oregon, and Washington. And that goes into the model. And then the model suggests giving our harvest objectives, which is, conservation of the population into the future and not harvesting at maximum sustained yield, but a little bit backed off from that. So it's kind of a conservative model. So that model suggests the appropriate hunting frameworks for the following season, not the current, the following. And that has to do with the services timing of going through their regulation process. It used to be the current year, but now it's 1 year out. So our Western Mallards in this model suggest the duck hunting frameworks for all of the states in the Pacific Flyway. So that's 11 Western states that we're contributing our data to. We can always be more conservative than what the framework suggests. Generally, we're not. Generally, we stick with the frameworks because we've agreed to manage hunting off of these stocks and how we've done it to date. And that's what we use. Now, there are concerns from people that say, oh my gosh, we need to do something about mallards. We need to back off. Well, the problem is once you step out of that structured decision framework, right, that has objectives and goals and it's data fed, once you back out of that, what are you going to manage off of? Oh my gosh, the sky is falling, so we need to restrict honey or, you know, bag limit or reduce season length. How are we going to increase it again? What's our metric? So we like to have standards, right, and a structured decision framework on which we can manage these populations.
Well, I had this conversation recently with somebody that was talking about the mallards and how we need to, you know, decrease it from 7. And, you know, we're kind of talking about, you know, where a lot of the hunting is and people that are harvesting the mallards, et cetera. And I was like, well, you know, would you be happy with 3 mallards? And they're like, no. I was like,
well, that's what it would take if you wanted to make impact, right, to reducing the harvest.
Right.
That's what it would take.
Absolutely. Yeah. But everyone's like, well, I'd be fine with 5. I was like, well, then it, then you're five fine. Do it. Then you're fine with seven because it's at the end of the year, it's going to be the same. Exactly. So I think
there
a lot of
no different.
Yeah, a lot of people have they. I don't know what their thought process is, but yeah, it's like if you want to self-regulate at five, go for it, you know. But essentially, at the end of the day, if it's five or seven, it's going to be the same at the end of the year. And
that's
a lot of
right. It's a function of what does the average hunter take home on a particular hunt day, and most hunters do not achieve the bag limit. The average is really low; it's mm-hmm. around two or for ducks, and it's about the same for geese too. So if you wanted to reduce harvest, you would have to reduce the bag limit from seven to say three.
Yeah, no one's willing to do that. You know, the people that are exactly. are shooting the mallards. Yeah, cause, and especially if you take that of, you know, rice, et cetera, you know, those particular places probably aren't shooting many mallards throughout the entire season, let alone a given day. So it makes it tough for folks. But they, you know, back in, you know, 99 and 96, et cetera, when the mallard populations were, what, over a half a million, you know, a lot more mallards on the landscape than there technically are now, but it doesn't matter from, you know, five to seven, but no one's willing to say, yes, I'll go for three. So.
Exactly. Well, I mean, they want to do the right thing. They care about the resource, but there's a lack of understanding for, I can't put it any other way. There's a lack of understanding on the average hunter and the bag limit that they achieve on any one hunting outing. And right now, harvest is not an issue on these populations, right? We look at harvest rates and they're not really increasing over time, at least in California. They're not increasing. And if you were, quote, over harvesting a particular population, you would expect those harvest rates to go up, and they have not on our California mallards. In fact, we're a little bit lower than the flyway as a big picture. So something to think about. It really has to do with habitat.
And does that go around for like all other species? Overall take is pretty much kind of the same year in and year out for the most part.
You mean total harvest?
Yeah, total harvest, excuse me.
Oh, I'd have to go look.
So if we got average two birds, you know, per hunter, is that kind of like a, in lesser word, a flat line in terms of, you know, no matter what, that's kind of just always a typical year is, you know, two to three birds.
Yeah. That is pretty consistent. What changes, I think, is success of individual hunters. If there's a really good year, we have good hunting weather, right? We could have great populations, but if you don't have weather moving birds around, you're probably not going to be successful on that particular day.
Yep.
So there's a lot of different variables, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But when we have higher populations, you can expect higher harvest. That's it. You can't shoot what you don't have.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I mean, you make a good point. Without the weather, without getting the birds moving, et cetera, you don't see those, you know, those birds. I remember touring Sac Refuge one time, and it was mid-November. There wasn't a whole lot going on, and we went out to, I think it was Pool 9 or something like that, and I don't think I've ever seen so many ducks in my life, and you'd be amazed of how many ducks are just sitting all day and then flying at night after shoot time. But there was a ton.
There's no reason to move.
Absolutely. So if it's the same weather every single day, expect the same results every day because the ducks are doing their own thing.
Right. And then you have these huge areas that may not be hunted as much as a public hunt area, for example. You know, they're going to hold a lot of ducks. The ducks are going to go to an area where they're not hunted. And there's a few duck clubs that are pretty large and have excellent habitat, and they're not hunted very often at all. So they're going to hold the ducks.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. We try to hold as many ducks as we can on our properties, but it's all pressure, right? You know, if it's pressured a lot, the birds are going to find safe refuge. In terms of some of the other stuff during like the waterfowl season, are you going through these same transects of over and over, same transects as the spring, or do you guys have different transects to look at the populations during the fall?
So completely different survey. So, you know, we've used the breeding pair survey in its current form since 91, because that's how we're able to compare, you know, to previous years, whether the population has gone up or down is having, you know, standard set strata and transects. And so that's our breeding pair survey in the spring. And then in the winter time, it's a little different. We do have what you would call the midwinter survey. We've also been doing that since the late 40s. It's changed somewhat over time. It's standardized now. There are transects. It's throughout the valley. It takes two or three days of flying, and we can't do it alone. We have to rely on the Fish and Wildlife Service to aid us, and hopefully that will continue going forward. We're not really sure because of budgets and staff reductions, so that could be at risk. We generally don't set regulations based on what we see in the winter, wintering populations, but it helps in terms of distribution and to track what we've got wintering in our state, because we are obligated to provide wintering habitat. California is very important in North America in terms of a wintering place, right? We host a good chunk of the pintail that breed in North America. So we do have an obligation to provide habitat and continue to monitor wintering birds so they're successful when they return to their breeding grounds. It depends what we're talking about. Geese, we fly the white-fronted goose survey in mid-October. So that's used to monitor the population combined with what they do in the summer in Alaska. Mm-hmm. Then we fly in early December for white geese and swans. And then we have the midwinter, that's the first full week in January. And you know, it's just because we're such an important wintering state, it makes a heck of a lot of good sense to continue to monitor what's coming to our state. I mean, you can monitor the breeding grounds and you know what your breeding population is, but if you're not monitoring the wintering grounds, I don't know how we can be responsive to habitat changes or providing adequate habitat. And that's where the Central Valley Joint Venture comes into play. And, you know, they use that data for making sure we're meeting habitat goals for wintering birds as well.
And do you guys go back on some of the data and kind of correlate it with, you know, we had great spring numbers, the fall numbers should be great as well. Do you look at both to kind of make sure that you guys are on track?
Oh, there's so many variables when it comes to what we produce locally and what winters here. Not a direct correlation. Mm-hmm. We get, you know, most of our wintering birds come from elsewhere, right? Mallards are produced locally or within the flyway, but most of the other species we get from elsewhere, and there's a lot, right? We're talking millions, so. Kind of apples and oranges.
Right. Okay. One bird did pop out on the surveys was, you know, definitely the increase in mute swans. I think people have seen more and more of those around, obviously, you know, here throughout the summer months, et cetera. But people might have a hard time identifying those to, you know, some of the other swans that are wintering here in the fall. But do you ever think of any other potential species like, you know, speckle bellies, et cetera, ever taking up locally and potentially nesting here? Do you think that would ever likely happen? I mean, obviously we have a ton of resident Canada geese now. I don't think specks are going to be like that, but I've seen some around, you know, in the summertime in the Delta, et cetera. I don't think they were nesting, but they were there in very odd times, which I thought was weird.
Yeah. Was it in the summer that you saw them or late spring?
It was the summer months. It was like, you know, June, July.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Subadults, the birds that are not old enough to breed yet, we typically see them staying later into mm-hmm. the spring than the most that move out of the state. The ones you see in the summer like that more than likely are injured, right? They can't make the flight back north.
That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. We see white geese too on SAC complex. There's always a handful of snows or ross that stay behind because injuries probably.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to say without monitoring those individuals and seeing what they're doing. You know, you can't say no way they would never breed here. There probably is a nest or two floating around. But for geese to change their distribution from Alaska and to stay here, that would be pretty significant.
Yeah.
And we would never see sometimes, right? Talking many, many hundreds of years.
Right.
With a Canada geese, they historically bred in the state. In northeastern California, they've widened yeah. their distribution and followed humans and their human-made ponds and the nice grass that surrounds them. Mm-hmm. So they're taking advantage of what humans put on the landscape, and so they're following us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, now we have the early season goose hunts down here, et cetera. I mean, the northeast populations is all, you know, it's a totally different population from down here. And that's why we have the different limits from the northeast zone to the Sac Valley. But I always kind of find it interesting just to, you know, look over the numbers year to year, and you can't really correlate it to, you know, your potential success, because some of the things that we mentioned earlier, you know, weather in particular being a huge factor in hunter success for a ton of different reasons. But I think everyone's excited to see the numbers start going back up after these wet years in a row, and hopefully, you know, we're out of that drought cycle for a while, because that was extremely hard on hunters and waterfowl and wetland managers to, you know, provide habitat for the ducks and the wintering population. So hopefully I don't see that in the next couple of years. That would be nice.
Hopefully we're in the boom cycle right now and not the bust, and we'll continue with a few more years of a positive trend, and that would feel really nice.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You guys do an awesome job. There's a lot of work to be done there. And it doesn't seem like you guys have a ginormous team to be doing it. So,
no. It's a pretty small unit. It always has. Although in the 70s, I think we had a larger staff. But of course, way back then, we didn't have the bureaucracy or the administrative tasks that mm-hmm. we're with now. So it is a little bit different. It's just myself and Caroline Brady that came from CWA. And then recently we have another waterfowl person that's about half time, and the other half is spent in the upland program, and that's Andrea Mott. So it's 2.5 of us in the waterfowl unit. And like I said earlier, we're very lucky that we have the funding, we have the support from the California NGOs, CWA, and working with the flyway system, the other states and the service, and we have a really nice structured approach to manage this resource. And for the most part, it's gone really well.
Good. Well, thank you so much for joining us today and giving us some of your time. And obviously everything that you guys are doing for waterfowl in our state and beyond. So Melanie, thank you so much for joining us today.
You are more than welcome, and happy hunting.
Awesome. Thanks, Melanie.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.